was not only admiration for him, but also a perspective that this was not just one man, but a movement that pulled this off, this change. And it was a movement that was organized in a democratic manner from the bottom up, not the top down. So, you know, even though we revere and admire Mandela, we have to also pay respect to the people of South Africa who suffered all these years, you know, torture, imprisonment, death, fighting apartheid.
That was Danny Schechter, the news dissector. He was joining us in 2013. He has died of pancreatic cancer. You can watch the rest of that interview as well as all of his appearances on Democracy Now! At democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Nafel Saramata, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkaff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Charlie Roberts. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO.
This is Democracy.
Portland. The time is now 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline on March 23rd at 6:30 p.m. to hear part two of Maya Shenhwar speaking about her book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work, and How We Can Do Better. Professor Rachel Cunliffe will also be giving commentary during part two.
Building a different world beyond prison is not just about knocking prison down, it's about raising up not only alternatives to dealing with conflict, but a world where people are cared for. If people are cared for, you're going to see a lot less harm. You're going to see a lot less violence, and you're going to see fewer survival times, too.
Again, that's March 23rd at 6:30 p.m. for part two of this conversation with Maya Shenhwar.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a man held in Washington County Jail for 905 days is released.
The United Nations releases a report on global water shortage.
And Portland Park Rangers will work with Right to Dream 2 on homeless relations.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 20th, 2015. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. A 52-year-old homeless man was stabbed on the Hawthorne Bridge Wednesday night. He was attacked by five young men described as street kids by witnesses. His wounds were not fatal. Anyone with information about the incident should call the police at 503-823-3333. The Coalition for the Homeless has reported that increasing criminalization of the homeless by cities is directly correlated to hate crimes against the homeless. Despite these setbacks, there are efforts to expand the rights of the houseless in a number of states, including Oregon. Last week in Salem, there was a rally to support a homeless bill of rights. This week, the city of Indianapolis narrowly failed to pass a bill defending the rights of the homeless, and the Hawaii State Senate passed a similar bill before it was deferred by a House committee.
Portland Parks and Recreation will be teaming up with Right to Dream 2 to enhance training for Portland Park Rangers when dealing with homeless people within city parks. City Commissioner Amanda Fritz initiated the agreement after a new booster bill provided for additional ranger training was passed. So far, only one training session has been scheduled and no money has been mentioned, but Right to Dream 2 Vice Chair Brad Gibson confirmed that the city has reached out to his organization in an effort to create better ranger relations with the homeless. Portland parks have become friendlier to the homeless within the past year, largely at the urging of Commissioner Fritz. In August, a new policy was enacted to allow people to sleep in the parks until 8 a.m., although this has since been changed to 7 a.m. Despite these gains, Gibson said, there are still many reports of harassment of the homeless at the hands of park rangers. The training by Right to Dream 2 will take place April 1st.
Benito Vasquez Hernandez, who's been held in a Washington County jail as a material witness to his son's murder trial for 905 days, was released yesterday after testifying before a court. The Spanish-speaking man has been held for over 2.5 years due to a material witness clause that allows investigators to detain an individual if they're uncertain whether he'll appear to testify at the trial. Due to difficulties with the language barrier and being unfamiliar with the American judicial system, Vasquez Hernandez was held for the unprecedented amount of time as the judicial process slowly moved forward. Under Oregon law, detained material witnesses must be compensated $7.50 for every day held. Vasquez Hernandez left the jail yesterday with roughly $6,000 in compensation, roughly $1,000 short of the amount due him. He was dropped off by police officers at an intersection outside Cornelius. The officer said he didn't indicate what his plans were. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier with Jan Carson from the Oregon ACLU.
I'm Jan Carson, the Associate Director of the ACLU of Oregon.
Great. Well, so today we want to talk about Benito Vasquez Hernandez's release from a Washington County jail. He was being held as a material witness to his son's murder trial and was released today after 905 days in jail despite committing no crime. Could you talk about how such an imprisonment of an entirely innocent human is possible within the current Oregon criminal justice system?
The material witness statute is there for a purpose. There are times that the only way to guarantee a witness being available to testify in an important criminal trial is to detain them. The ACLU recognizes this, but we find it very problematic to detain anyone who has not been accused of a crime. From what I can understand is across the country, as well as in Oregon, material witnesses are rarely held more than a week or two to ensure they're to guarantee their testimony. So the fact that this person was held over 900 days is very troubling.
How is it legal? Is there no sort of limitation or like some sort of time limit which you can detain someone for? Is it an indefinite amount of time in Oregon?
My understanding is the statute does not have any limitation on the amount of time. There are many factors that go into this that I'm just not privy to all of the factors. There is a, you know, there are some ways to challenge the detention. Oregon's statute does provide material witnesses the right to a lawyer. So this person did have a lawyer representing his interests throughout this process. A choice was made not to go to the Oregon Supreme Court to seek an earlier release of this individual. I don't know the factors that were involved in making that decision, but that is an option. They could have gone to the Oregon Supreme Court and said the length of time that he's being held is too long and release him. But that didn't happen. I am grateful that he has been finally released upon providing testimony.
Does the ACLU, obviously, as you said before, they recognize the ability of the justice system to detain material witnesses, but do you feel like there are anything, or does the ACLU feel like there is anything at work in this situation that particularly violates Vasquez Hernandez's rights for being in prison for that long?
I would hope that this experience, as rare as it is, and I hope it would remain rare, will be looked at to see are there other ways to handle this? You know, were there other less restrictive ways to ensure his availability at trial to testify? Electronic bracelets are used a lot on individuals instead of incarceration. Keeping someone in jail is not only a terrible deprivation of someone's liberty, it's also expensive. So I would hope that this instance will create some thinking about other options for ensuring a witness's availability to testify.
That was Jan Carson with the Oregon ACLU, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
Portland City Auditor Hull Caballero announced today that the Portland Police Union has been intimidating the Independent Police Review Division. Hull Caballero's office oversees this civilian review board. She informed the mayor and city council of the situation last week. Disappointed with their response, she decided to go public. She reports that the chief of police leaked classified information about a civilian review board's investigator to the police union. In addition, the city auditor reports that the president of the union, police union, harassed and intimidated a different investigator from the civilian review board. As a result, the civilian review board created a policy requiring two investigators to be present when meeting with the police. The police union is challenging the presence of investigators at the review board hearings, saying that their presence is illegal.
A group of Oregon homeowners, fed up with the lack of help from government agencies and the courts fighting illegal foreclosures, have organized a grassroots campaign called the Homeowner Survivors Guild. Members of the guild gathered outside the Multnomah County Courthouse today in support of a couple that has been fighting to save their home for the past 5 years. The group is trying to end fraudulent practices used by banks and loan servicers to put people out of their homes. The homeowners spoke with KBOO outside the courthouse today.
I'm Lorna Bracken-Baxter, and I am dealing with my own home situation, and that has been incredible. Been dealing with it for 2.5 years, being able to stave off the foreclosure lawyer. But I've gone through several servicers, just as when I get the letter that says, we have your mortgage, you know, paperwork, and we're going to review it. They've sold it to another lender. So we're here today to bring public awareness to the abuse and fraud that's being committed by banks, mortgage handlers. The courts are failing the homeowners by turning a blind eye to the fraud. Legislature, laws that have been passed by legislature are not being enforced by the Department of Justice. Mandatory mediation is a failure. There's no enforcement. Organizations that homeowners are led to that are to help mediate or help process a modification and work with the mortgage lenders are just sort of buffers put into place, but they aren't really helping. It's sort of like, and organizations that are there to file complaints against servicers that are being unscrupulous. Most people have seen in the news, not only locally but nationally, that you go to do a modification and they lose the paperwork and you have to keep faxing and they don't answer your calls, and then you have to redo it, and they just keep stretching this out until the final thing is for you to lose your home. Their intent is to foreclose. So there really isn't anybody out there that helps people and helps educate them on some of the things that the legal system is doing fraudulently. And the representatives for the banks and the lenders are trying to pull all kinds of things. They don't really have title to your home. They don't have the documents that they claim they do. And unless you know these things, you're beaten down before you start. You say, well, you know, I'm going to lose my home. They told me, you know, they're going to take my home, so I've got to move out. And it's like, no, you don't. A lot of the documentation is fraudulent.
I'm Cindy Lorenz. and we bought the property back in 2006. And the mortgage company, we did attempt to make a loan modification, and the same date we was approved is the same date we went into foreclosure on a non-judicial. We've already went through several cases that's been dismissed that we won, and they came back judicial this time.
Wow. So now they're saying that that you are going to have to leave your home and that they're foreclosing on it?
Yes, that's correct. When there is no money owed on the property, they're still forcefully coming in trying to steal the property.
And what company is this?
They're foreclosing in the name of Deutsche Bank National Trust Company.
And you have paid off the mortgage?
Yes, it was paid back in 2007.
And so are you prepared to stay in your home if the judge rules against you again?
Well, we have the right of redemption period, and we don't have any plans at this time, and hope that the judge is lenient and lets us do our challenge of the writ of execution pending on our appeal, because we have an appeal in process.
So what happens if the judge today rules that the writ of execution can move forward, the sheriffs force you from your house, and then the appellate court rules in your favor and the foreclosure is overturned?
Then it gets really messy, because then we have Remedy and the foreclosing attorneys, and Deutsche Bank, which really isn't even a party of interest, has to pay for the damages they've caused me and my husband and my family.
A group of Oregon homeowners, those were members of the Homeowners Survivors Guild. They spoke today outside the Multnomah County Courthouse in support of a couple fighting foreclosure. The group can be reached at 503-655-4565.
Earlier this week, the Presbyterian Church approved marriage equality in the first ever nationwide grassroots vote on marriage equality by a faith tradition. A Beaverton church was instrumental in this vote. Beaverton Southminster Presbyterian Church initiated the amendment after a series of courses studying marriage and sermons reviewing the issue. Recently installed Pastor John Shuck, who has been involved in fighting for equality and social justice for decades.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses, a forum offering feminist commentary at 6 o'clock. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, 62 degrees and rainy. And then Sunday, 57 degrees and rainy. Today in history, in 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe's book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, was published. And in 1916, Albert Einstein published his General Theory of Relativity. The quote of the day is from Albert Einstein. When you are courting a nice girl, an hour seems like a second. When you sit on a red-hot cinder, a second seems like an hour. That's relativity.
Go to KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about the Beaverton Church's role in the recent church vote for marriage equality.
Chuck, can you tell us about the role that your church played in the formation of this week's decision?
Sure. Our congregation was one of many congregations across the nation that submitted overtures to their presbyteries. And so our congregation submitted an overture to change the definition of marriage from a man and a woman to two people in the Presbyterian Constitution. And that was sent to our presbytery, which is a collection of congregations, and ours is Cascade Presbytery, which covers the congregations in Western Oregon. And after that was submitted, it was language basically changed, you know, with advocacy groups and different folks to make it happen. And then that was submitted to the General Assembly, and the Cascades Presbytery version of a number were chosen as the one that ended up being the one that was finally voted on by, again, all of the General Assembly in June, as well as the presbyteries across the country. And that 86th vote, the 51% of them, happened this past week on St. Patrick's Day. And so it approved. So we were instrumental. We weren't the only ones. We work in partnership with others, but instrumental in making this change happen across the country in the Presbyterian Church.
And I understand it was Beaverton Southminster Presbyterian Church that initiated the amendment. How did that come about?
Well, it worked out with my my predecessor minister. I just started serving here 2 months ago, so this was before me. But she went to the adult class and said, "Why don't you take on this issue and study this?" And they did. And so they studied it and came up with a resolution to change the definition of the Book of Order. And so it was an exciting thing. And so, and then they went through the process of sending that up to the presbytery, and it made it happen. Like I say, obviously this movement has been happening within the Presbyterian Church for some time, and different groups have all been working toward it. Now, our congregation and me, myself, have been doing this for a long time, even before, you know, marriage equality happened. We've been doing Holy Union services or those kinds of things as a matter of conscience. And so that hard work is finally paid off in having it written in the Constitution itself.
In doing that in the past, were you at risk for facing some sort of censure from church authorities?
Yes. In fact, my colleagues were some of them activists. Janie Spar, for example, was put on church trial and all of that. Myself, I was excited in 2013 to do a wedding for my daughter and her wife. They were from Tennessee, but we did the wedding in New York State, where it was legal, and I did it as a Presbyterian minister, and that was before the change happened. So, and about 200 of us had signed statements, ministers, that is, that we would do these things as a matter of conscience. But so many of us went out and did it, too many to take to church court, I suppose.
And now the church will allow these ceremonies to go on within the rules of the church?
You mean within the sanctuary of the church or within, yeah, and within legal rules of the church, absolutely, yes. So now if a gay or lesbian couple wanted to get married in a Presbyterian church, there'd be no church problems with any of that.
Reverend Chuck is with Southminster Presbyterian Church, located at the corner of Hall and Denny Roads in Beaverton. The Southminster Presbyterian Church was instrumental in pushing the amendment that was recently passed in the Presbyterian Church, allowing for marriage equality within the church. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Today, the Obama administration unveiled the first guidelines ever to regulate the still-booming fracking industry on federal lands. The regulations released through the Department of Interior require fracking companies to detail all of the chemicals being pumped into the ground during fracking procedures to the Bureau of Land Management. It would also require companies to release detailed geological accounts of all existing natural gas wells and allow government inspectors to impose new standards standards on the storage of toxic wastewater. The new rules would only apply to tribal and federal lands, which cover roughly 92,000 wells, responsible for 11% of the natural gas production and 5% of oil production in the country. All other fracking operations are under the jurisdiction of state and local governments, and although the federal government doesn't have the authority to regulate those operations, the Department of Interior hopes the new rules will be used as an example for state and local regulation. Environmental activists and industry representatives criticize the new regulations, the former believing them too lax, while the latter too restrictive. Environmentalists point out that the rules only require a detailed list of chemicals pumped into the ground after they've already been put there, hardly preventing toxic contamination of groundwater reserves that supply millions of Americans. Industry, on the other hand, claims the rules merely duplicate regulations that some states have in place, arguing that this will produce tedious burdens on the fossil fuel companies involved. Despite being heavily opposed by congressional Republicans, the Department of Interior believes the new rules are justified and that they will stick.
Earlier today, the United Nations released a report saying that by 2030, the world will have only 60% of the water it needs. In places like Brazil and California, which are both suffering severe droughts this year, the effects of this coming water shortage are already apparent. The state of California has tightened restrictions on water use this week in response to a drought that has lasted for years. It's been classified as exceptional, which is a step above extreme. The UN report blames population growth and government policies that prioritize economic investment over conservation. Climate change is also worsening the situation, causing droughts to become more common and more severe. Americans use about 10 gallons of water a day on average. The single largest use of water is flushing toilets.
Headlines this week surprised the progressive community in the United States when they declared that there were members of the progressive community in support of a trade agreement known as the TPP. Since there has until now been an overwhelming consensus among the left that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be harmful to U.S. workers and the environment, the introduction of a new group that claims support of the TPP came as quite a surprise. It turns out that the new organization, calling itself Progressive Coalition for American Jobs, has close and long-standing ties to the White House. Neil Soroka from Democracy for America spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the organization.
This progressive coalition is neither progressive nor a coalition, but it's clear that they support the job-killing, really horrible Trans-Pacific Partnership. For those that aren't aware, and I know a lot of listeners to this station are, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a massive NAFTA-style trade deal that has been negotiated in secret by governments around the world and over 500 corporate negotiators. We don't actually know what's in the deal because it's being kept under literally lock and key in Washington. And up until today, even members of Congress weren't allowed to read the full bill with the help of staff members. So we don't know what's in the full deal. The very little that we know that's been leaked out during the process, we know it's going to be really bad for American people. NAFTA and NAFTA-style trade deals has only increased our trade deficit, has led to greater job losses in Oregon and around the country. We also know the TPP does a lot of things, like, frankly, make it easier for substandard food products to get to market here in the United States. And it's going to increase trade with countries like Brunei that brutalize unmarried women with children and gay people, as well as they allow for the public flogging and killing of Christians. This is a trade deal that makes no sense. It's bad for folks in the United States. It doesn't hold our values. And frankly, it's just going to be a big win for the large corporations who are already doing a lot of damage to our country and working families right here in America.
I did get a brief look at the website of the Progressive Coalition for American Jobs. It's kind of the black box derivative of websites because it was kind of generic in terms of there doesn't seem to be any information about who is on staff. There doesn't seem to be any information about which organizations they are partnering with. I've been able to discover in relation to them is that they're a client of a place called 270 Strategies.
That's right. 270 Strategies is a firm that was founded by Jeremy Byrd and Mitch Stewart, two individuals who worked on the Obama campaign. But the work that his firm, 270 Strategies, is doing with this fake AstroTurf so-called progressive coalition is really disturbing. This isn't just mere selling out to corporate greed, corporations who are trying to push this Trans-Pacific partnership through. What's so nefarious about what the Progressive Coalition for American Jobs, or whatever the heck this fake group is called, is that it's actually trying not just to pass the TPP and fast-track authority, but it's actually trying to break progressive solidarity against the Trans-Pacific Partnership and against fast-track authority. There is no progressive organization. There is no outspoken progressive advocates outside of the White House for fast-track authority or the TPP. In fact, the progressive community is almost unanimous in its opposition to fast-track authority and the TPP. This group is just a classic Washington fake AstroTurf organization. It's designed to look like there's grassroots support behind their position when there actually is none.
Given the track records of the free trade agreements prior to the TPP, how would you characterize the level of credibility in promoting this treaty as a jobs creator?
There's zero credibility in calling this a job creator. There is a clear, direct correlation between the enactment of NAFTA and the literally millions of jobs that flooded across our borders afterwards.
So what's next as it pertains to the process of the TPP? How soon can the next development occur?
Oregonians actually have an incredibly important role to fight in this process. Senator Wyden is playing a very important role in the fight over fast-track authority. Right now, he is the sole person who can decide whether or not fast-track authority in the U.S. Senate is given a bipartisan fig leaf, whether Republicans can pretend that Democrats support it if Ron Wyden signs off on it and approves it. So the folks in Portland who are listening to this right now, make your voices heard and make sure that Ron Wyden knows that you don't want him passing and supporting the passage of fast-track authority through the U.S. Senate. We can change his mind. We can pull him back from working to pass fast-track authority and give it this bipartisan fig leaf. And if we stop fast-track authority, that's going to be an incredibly important victory in the larger battle against the TPP. But it starts with fast-track. It starts with Senator Ron Wyden.
For folks who are listening to the conversation that we're having and want to know more, is there a website